Have you ever known a dog that chewed his paws obsessively or that barked in panic when his owner left or felt a pang of recognition for the primate staring out from his cage at the local zoo, wondering what's going through his mind? In the book Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves, Laurel Breitman, a historian of science with a PhD from MIT, endeavors to answer the questions about the innermost workings of the animal mind, especially when they're in anguish. What she discovers is a connection between humans and many other animals, not only in the ways that they lose their minds, but in the ways they heal. Again, the title of the book is Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel Breitman, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Very nice to have you with us. What brought you to this idea, to this field of study?
Well, I should say I probably always loved the most difficult animals the best. You know, as challenging as that can be, they stretch us in interesting directions. You know, it's kind of easy to love someone with no behavioral issues or crippling anxiety. It's a little bit more challenging to love someone with those kinds of problems. But for me, the most dramatic moment was right after I adopted a Bernese mountain dog with my ex-husband. And for the first 6 months, he was just an amazing dream of a creature. So sweet and warm and affectionate and well-behaved. And then about 6 months in, he developed absolutely crippling separation anxiety to the point where it really changed our entire lives. And I had to turn everything upside down to try and help him because he was such a danger to himself.
So how much do you think that was on you and how much on the dog?
Oh, well, it's a little hard to tease out. He was a rescue. So a lot of his problems stem from the fact that he had been abandoned by his last family, who loved him dearly. I really do think they cared about him. He wasn't exactly, you know, abused and mistreated. And I think that's the case with a lot of these animals. You know, we do our best as pet owners for the most part, and sometimes our best isn't good enough. And his old family, the teenage daughter in the family had a baby and decided to keep the baby. And Oliver had basically been, you know, the center of the family in terms of the attention he was getting. And then suddenly he was displaced by this infant. And he just wasn't getting as much attention. And he acted up in the ways that dogs do, you know, by becoming more needy and tearing things up and pooping and peeing where he wasn't supposed to and just generally making a best of himself, trying to get attention. And the family reacted by kind of locking him up, which sounds actually worse than it was. You know, I think they were putting him in guest rooms. They were putting him in the garage. The unfortunate thing is they put him inside a crate and without training him that a crate was a safe place to be. So he really developed a fear of being kept away from his people, and he would do everything in his power in order, you know, to chew or claw his way back to where humans were. He was terrified of being left on his own, which was heartbreaking.
So when it comes to animal madness, it indicates that humans are not the only ones, of course, with mental health issues. So it gets to the question, as you address in the book, as to how you deal with it. And one of the things that's surprising in the book is how it is so often dealt with, and much more than I knew about, is often dealt with a pharmaceutical cure.
Absolutely. I mean, in a lot of ways, it shouldn't be too surprising. 1 in 5 Americans is on a psychopharmaceutical drug right now, whether that's an anxiety med or an antidepressant or an antipsychotic. And so just like we always have, we treat the animals that live with us with the same remedies that we use on ourselves, and that goes back, you know, hundreds of years. So it just so happens that we're treating these things now and people with psychopharmaceuticals, and so I think, we're also extending those drugs to our pets. The problem is when it doesn't treat the underlying issue that's, you know, driving the dog or cat or parrot to distraction. So I think that drugs can be helpful, just like they can in people. They can give you a pause on the crippling anxiety you're feeling in order to make lifestyle changes or start seeing a therapist and develop coping mechanisms. So they can be helpful, but they shouldn't be a replacement for all the other things you can do to cheer an animal up and make them feel better.
But what fascinates me is if one in five of us is on such a drug, is there a parallel to the one in five of the animals that are suffering from, in many cases, the same illness?
Absolutely. I mean, I think none of us are prepared in for the lives we're leading right now. You know, I don't know about you, but I spend so much time in front of a computer screen. You know, I'm not evolved for that. You know, my lower back hurts. My eyes get fuzzy. You know, I get grouchy. I probably eat more unhealthily than I should. You know, there's so much about our lives as sedentary creatures now, working in offices where we don't get to run around and we're not around other animals that don't serve us. And I think that's very true for the animals left at home. You know, dogs in particular are social creatures. They're not meant to stay at home for 8 hours while we're at work. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, what this book, researching this book did for me, and also spending time with all of the different people I talked to about how to help our animals through this, was that, you know, identifying them with them and their suffering and thinking of ourselves similarly, what is not a bad idea. You know, a lot of us are very embarrassed for the fact that we have, like, secret dog voices we use when no one's around. You know, we all have a dog voice we use to talk
sure.
for our dogs.
Yeah.
You know, and the silly, embarrassing, goofy nicknames for them we don't say in public. And I think a lot of us are embarrassed about that, but we shouldn't be. I think seeing our own anxieties and our own mood disorders and so many of these other things in our other animals can actually help us help them and ourselves by extension.
So I guess this is one of those, which comes first, the chicken or the egg question. So if we're using, because in some ways we're using the animal to heal. I mean, one of the reasons we get the animal is to have something to love and to nurture. But also, in some cases, we are causing the problem. If we have a panic or an anxiety disorder, we can often bring that out in the animal. If you're a type A person, then it's rarer that you're going to have a calm dog, right?
Yes. I mean, I don't have scientific studies to back that one up, but I absolutely agree with you. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's just like people and their children often. You know, you develop the... You mirror the people around you and their reactions to things. If you have a dog and you're terrified of cats or you're terrified of stairs, that dog is going to pick up from you that maybe stairs aren't the safest things because they see how you react, particularly a puppy. They have to learn from the world around them.
Right.
And they're human.
So who helps who? I mean, is it our responsibility to help them, or ultimately do we have to take the lead from the animal? And in many cases, I feel that they're smarter in this regard, that take the lead from the animal and follow, as you said, you know, they're not hardwired to be home 8 hours. And maybe we say, okay, well, we should be home more. And then things start to level out.
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I think the ideal relationship is one in which we are therapy animals for each other. You know, we're used to this idea of seeing therapy dogs at work, you know, who were working dogs, who wear jackets. But I really think that most people who have animals with any sort of behavioral emotional issue are actually therapy animals themselves. You know, I often felt when I was trying to help my dog that I ought to be walking around with one of those little jackets. Like, don't touch me. I'm working here. please don't distract me from what I'm trying to train my dog to do. You know, he's suffering. You can't tell. He's cute. Don't touch him, you know. So I think we actually just need to shift how we think about it a little bit. There's so much we can do to help them. And the truth is that when you do help a creature, there's so much self-confidence that comes out of that and just joy. If you help your hamster, you know, to stop running compulsively on the wheel, or you ease your parrot's anxiety or loneliness and they stop plucking their feathers, you know, these are the little triumphs of life with other creatures. And I don't want to make any of your listeners feel bad if they have a plucking parrot who they've tried to help and it's gone awry, because also, you know, what I want to do with this book is make people feel less alone.
Yes.
We have so much guilt when we have an animal we can't help, and I really do think most people are doing their best.
Are cats different?
Absolutely.
Because I read the book, and I just felt like cats seemed to go under the radar a little bit.
Oh, yes, you've discovered my inner bias. If all of humanity is on a continuum with between the dog pole and the cat pole, I'm decidedly on the dog side. But I love and adore cats. They make me feel like I'm back in junior high again in a lot of ways, you know, where I'm like the girl at the dance that hasn't been asked yet. You know, I feel like with cats you have to do so much work to charm them and make them like you. Which I embrace as a challenge, but I don't currently have a cat in my life.
But they seem,
I should.
Well, we all should, I think, but they seem more centered. They seem as if they have a more of a sense of what's going on and confidence.
Yeah, well, not all cats, but
no.
I hear you. I mean, I do think they are more independent. You know, when I have
right.
lived with cats, I haven't felt like I'm, you know, part of a pride. But when I do live with dogs, I tend to feel like I'm part of a pack.
Right.
But definitely, I have come across a lot of unself-confident cats. Therein lies a whole slew of behavioral problems that often, you know, like inappropriate spraying, for example. I have a friend and her girlfriend, once they started dating, her girlfriend constantly, every time she spent the night or came to visit the cat, would spray on her suitcase. She eventually had to throw out the suitcase and get a new one. But the cat was not happy about the new girlfriend. And unfortunately for a lot of cats, they then end up going to visit what David Sedaris calls the euthanasia, which, you know, is a sad state of affairs. And often what the stakes are for cats and dogs who, you know, quote unquote, are misbehaving, which really just means usually that they're upset about something.
Oral Braitman is the author of the book Animal Madness, which is published by Simon and Schuster. You talk, and I think it's a really interesting discussion in the book about anthropomorphism. It is something that is often used as a dirty word, the attribution of human perspectives onto non-humans, animals. And you ultimately make the case that there is some usefulness in that.
Absolutely. I think deciding to not anthropomorphize is basically impossible. You know, it's a beautiful dream, but we can't take our brains out of our human heads and put them in a jar and use them to think about other animals. If I could, I would, but that's just not something I want to do. It sounds dangerous. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, we will always be a human wondering and making assumptions about the behavior and motivations of another animal. So I think that we should embrace that and that we should use our animal capacities to identify with those creatures, particularly the ones who are extremely similar to us or that we spend a lot of time with. I think identifying with other animals is helpful, particularly when we're trying to figure out how to help them.
When alone, I talk a lot to my dog, and I feel that we have conversations. And the question I often have for myself is, do I really want him to be able to talk back? And I don't know the answer to that. Like, I'm worried what that would be like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be like being married to your dog. You know?
It's nice to have that one-sided conversation, and then I just think of, okay, but what, because you can tell so much. I mean, again, you know, not to, I guess, if it is okay then to anthropomorphize, then yes, that is what I'm doing, but by the same token, I mean, I feel that I can tell how they're feeling and saying, and sometimes it's things that I don't necessarily think I want to hear.
Yes. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And most of us, if we're being honest, do feel that way about the creatures we live with. That's why I think anthropomorphizing your dog is actually probably the best course of action when you're trying to figure out what's going on inside their head, because you know your dog. You know, it works less well on an animal that you don't have a baseline for.
Right.
One way to diagnose, you know, a disorder in an animal close to you is by comparing it to how they were before there was a change. And so you can really only identify, say, depression in a goat or a cat or an elephant if you knew that goat, cat, or elephant before they stopped eating and started acting listless, you know, say, after the loss of a close friend.
We know that dog, but I'm wondering if many of us know them well enough in the sense of that we want them to be something that they're not, and we don't allow them enough to be a dog or to be a cat or to be a parrot or to be a hamster. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a problem of modern life, because I actually don't think we allow ourselves to be animals enough of the time. You know, most of us are not getting, say, enough exercise during the day, let alone the animals we live with that need to run around.
Right.
So I actually think it's larger than a pet problem. I think it's a contemporary human problem, at least in the United States. We don't engage in enough physical activity, and we're suffering, but so are the creatures closest to us. You know, most Americans, and I believe most American dogs are overweight, you know.
Right.
We eat similarly to the creatures that we love. We take the same drugs. We do the same things at night. You know, we take a walk, and then we come back, and we watch TV together.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
And we feel bad that we've left them for so long, so we give them more than we normally would.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so guilty of that. I really have a hard time seeing an animal without giving them a treat. I always have something in my bag. And I think we should. You know, you wouldn't just go up to, say, a stranger on the bus and, like, pet them on the nape of the neck. You know, like, we're really well-behaved around other humans we don't know. But a lot of people on the street, and I've seen this in Boston many a time, you know, people rush up to a dog that looks cute and they fondle them inappropriately. So I think it's best to approach foreign creatures, even if they look really cute, as if they're a person that you don't know, and to proffer a treat and to ask their owner if it's okay to interact with them. We all deserve a little bit of respect.
Now, one of the things that you put on display in the book is that really it's ultimately inspirational, because you talk of so many stories of recovery of both the animal and the human that really come from your travels from all over the world.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, when I started doing this, they asked me why on earth I would want to do this. And this was both my PhD research and the subject of this book. So I spent a lot of years doing this work. And in the beginning, everyone said, you know, this sounds so depressing. Like, why would you study animal mental illness for years, you know? And I don't know, I was always sort of taken aback by that question, because I think it's the most positive thing I've ever been exposed to. I mean, suffering creatures tend to bring out the best in us. You know, they expose our humanity. I mean, there's one woman I write about in the book. Her name is Anne Southcombe. She's a wildlife rehabilitator in Northern California, and she rescues rabbits and squirrels. And she's turned her house basically into like this rabbit sanctuary, you know, and the rabbits eat piles of lettuce off the floor. She's not a hoarder by any means. She just lives in a house where it's organized around the rabbits' needs as opposed to the humans. And that was such a revelation. And here's this woman who literally serves salad on her very clean floor to her very clean and happy rabbits. And I think it's sort of miraculous to me, you know, the degree to which people often turn their lives upside down in order to start squirrel sanctuaries or elephant sanctuaries or to adopt donkeys or to rehabilitate pit bulls who've been abused. I think this brings out the very best of what it means to be a human alongside other creatures on this planet.
And it helps that animal, and ultimately it helps her.
Yes, I think very clearly by helping other animals, we help ourselves.
When we're not into sort of a saving mode and we're just trying to have a pet and get through life, here again, it can be a relationship, but it should be a relationship, but it's something that we, like any relationship, you do have to work at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think our relationship, in particular with our dogs and cats, we ought to think about much more similarly to our relationships with each other. You know, I don't mean that inappropriately by any means, but
well,
I think that, you know, you should think about them as part of your family, and most people do, but then they apologize for it,
yeah.
You know. But I think we shouldn't apologize for it. I really think we should embrace our secret dog conversations, and maybe we should be talking about them in public more often, because it makes us better dog companions. You know, if you ask your dog a question in one of your silent, or maybe just silent on your dog's end conversation, and you feel like you get an answer that's maybe inconvenient, like, hey, I hate that you stayed at work 3 hours later. Why did you just give me the 15-minute walk? I know you're cutting corners, and get off your cell phone. That's going to make your dog feel better if you take action. So I think whatever it takes to get people to that place, and I really think we should embrace it and not give ourselves a hard time about identifying with them.
And it's okay to feel guilty on our part if we're not doing enough for the animal.
Yes, and I would also like to give us all a break. I mean, I still feel terrible about what happened with my own dog. He ended up dying. I couldn't save him. And I mean, it's taken me the better part of a decade to get over that, to feel better. And what made me feel better was literally going around the world and talking to so many other people who were racked with guilt and felt like they didn't do enough. And the truth is that you could always do more, but you actually can't. There's so many hours in the day. And also the dog is who the dog is before they come to you. There is also only so much you can do. And if you've tried your best and, you know, your dog is still chewing tennis ball-sized holes in his paws or his chasing his tail or your cat won't stop pulling out all of her belly hair, at some point you have to say, my God, I've done my best here. And I'm just going to love this imperfect animal imperfectly and try to forgive myself.
And hope they love the imperfect me as well.
Absolutely. And give them treats.
Absolutely. The name of the book is Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Laurel Breitman, a great pleasure to speak with you this morning. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
A delight. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Animal Madness. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.